Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman. On this week's episode, we'll be discussing whether Macron is losing his gloss, asking if the Brexit talks are heading in the right direction, and recommending how to get the best out of the Edinburgh Festival. First, it's been just over 2 months since Emmanuel Macron became president of France, and already cracks are starting to show. He was swept into the Élysée Palace on a sea of young voters who wanted to reject Marine Le Pen and the National Front. But they seem to be beginning to turn on the centrist former banker who they reluctantly championed. So says Gavin Mortimer in this week's magazine, where he laments the new president's vanity. And he joins me now from Paris, along with the political journalist Marie Leconte. So Gavin, in your piece you draw a comparison between Macronism and Blairism. Can you just explain that a little bit more for listeners?
They're both trying to rebrand their country after what's gone before. In Blair's case, the grey years of John Major. And in Macron's case, the disastrous, shambolic 5 years of François Hollande and his socialist government. Really, French prestige on the international stage in particular took a real battering. And there was French bashing, the Anglo-Saxons mercilessly mocked. The French way of doing things, actually, in a way that began sort of with humour, the men actually turned rather nasty. So he wants to rebrand, reinvigorate France in the way that Blair tried in those 20 years ago with Cool Britannia.
And Marie, is that working? Are young people in France buying this new brand?
I don't really think they are, and I feel like, talking to friends in Paris who would be normally the exact audience for that kind of thing, like metropolitan liberals of like 20-somethings, they just find him really cringe and they don't really like the idea, because I think that the major difference between Blair and Macron is that Macron doesn't really have the country behind him, and so people voted for him because he wasn't far right or because he wasn't Fillon, who was, very socially conservative. So I think that people are like, well, actually, we didn't really want this. We kind of voted for it because we had to. I don't think he's going to be able to really take the country with him.
So what's going wrong in Camp Macron then, Gavin? Is this a rebrand that's not sincere as well? Is it a bit like a dad trying to pronounce the names of popular boy bands to their children?
Taking just one, for example, he said that during the election that he would cut by 10 billion euros public spending, and that's now risen to 13 billion. Then, of course, he had this big fallout with the head of the army, General Pierre de Villiers, last week over 850 million euros cuts to military finances at a time when the French military is very stretched. There's just recently housing benefits are going to be reduced by 5 euros per month per claimant. So that's all adding up. But as Marie says, it's the cringeworthiness of, he just seems unaware of what he's doing. It's all very well in inviting sports stars like the Lyon women's football team to the Elysee Palace to congratulate them on winning the Football Champions League. But it's another thing. So far, we've had him dressing up as a submariner, as a fighter pilot out of Top Gun. And you wonder what he's going to do next. And he dressed up as a fighter pilot last week to address personnel at an airbase in southern France, in the same week that he more or less forced out the very respected General de Villiers. And someone should have told him that this is perhaps not the best time to go, indulging your love of fancy dress.
Marie, are his policy announcements going down equally badly? Is the rebrand actually distracting from, and as Gavin says, slightly confusing some of them as well?
Well, I think this week there's been a lot of outrage against the proposed changes, is that so they will take 5 euros a month out of the APL, which is a housing benefit, and at the same time announcing that they would cut taxes for the very, very richest in France. So obviously, that has predictably led to fear around France. But then again, to be fair to him, he never said he was centre-left or anything. He was always a centre figure and now has a centre-right prime minister. But I think people are seeing this as a massive sign of things to come. I think there will be, because also Mélenchon's party, the far-left party, La France Insoumise, now has a fair few seats in Parliament, and I think that they are really able to drive this massive thing against Macron. I think they're organising a march as well next week. So it's not really going well already.
So Gavin, it sounds as though actually parading around in fancy dresses is the most productive thing that Macron can do. It doesn't sound as though politically he can really get very much done.
Well, of course, that's the job of the French system, is different to the UK in that Macron has a PM, Edouard Philippe, to do the dirty work, if you like. And one has the impression that Macron, he comes across as aloof, as uninterested in the mundane things. He wants the international stage. He loves rubbing shoulders with the leaders. And of course, credit where credit's due. Yesterday, he got the warring factions in Libya together in Paris, and there's a promise of a ceasefire and a promise of elections to come. He's going to be judged domestically. And of course, we've got, as Marie alluded to, the far left are gathering. There's the ever constant threat of another mass casualty Islamist attack, growing fears about the immigration, and with coming up from Italy. So he's, as I say in the piece, he's enjoying the summer while he can, because he knows that, you certainly hope he knows that bigger tests lie ahead. And I think what's going to be very interesting, talking to my French friends, is to see how he reacts, because he's had everything handed to him on a plate so far. He's been incredibly successful. But how does he react when things are outside his control? He's a control freak. So far, he's been able to control everything. Let's see how he reacts in the face of adversity.
Marie, how do you think he will react?
It is quite impossible to know, because again, as Gavin has said, the idea that, again, I think that we kind of had that from the UK of, sort of like Macron, like the incredible rise of Macron. And to be fair, what he did was incredible, but also it was partly because, everyone around him fell apart, the right fell apart, the left fell apart. And so he was left as the only one. So I think that he's never really had to fight, to properly sort of like, fight politically for what he wants. So we don't really know what's going to happen. And there will be strikes, with the Labour reforms he's going to try to get through the National Assembly. Like, there will be protests, the unions will go against him, and we have no idea. He's kind of like untested at this point, so it's genuinely a mystery, I think.
And Gavin, I suppose it's not just about domestic policy, is it, given that we have the Brexit negotiations starting up? What sort of a role is Macron playing in those so far?
But of course, he's taken quite a hard line against Brexit. But one wonders what his true feelings are, because it works to his advantage in a way to have Britain out of the way, because he is very, very keen on reinvigorating the France-Germany alliance, which has traditionally been at the heart of Europe. And he's wasted no time in cozying up to Angela Merkel, who's indulging him for the moment. But I think obviously her eye is on the September elections in Germany. So he is ever the opportunist, looking to attract disgruntled British brains to France, and saying that, as he said to American scientists after the Trump pulled out of the climate deal, there's always a home for you here. So he's making a pitch for them, which very much fits in with how he wants to rebrand France as a country of technology, not one of tradition, and really a sort of a go-forward country, if you like.
Marie, are there other world leaders who Macron could try to imitate rather than Blair? I'm thinking of the popularity of Justin Trudeau, for instance, in Canada. Mm.
Well, I think that's what he's aiming for, isn't it? With all the likes of, the photo ops and the kind of, the cool and fuzzy president. I think that's very much the Trudeau playbook. But then again, Trudeau is not having the nicest time either at the moment. I think, the electorate in Canada are starting to go, well, actually, could you please stop doing, you please just stop, so like going around the country and like taking really nice pictures with children and maybe do stuff. So I'm not sure that that's the best possible example. Obama may actually be good, because I think that's what he aspires to. Like, exactly, so like being the cool president, but I'm not sure he really has the shoulders to kind of carry that, at least right now.
And Obama, I suppose, wasn't particularly powerful in many ways either, was he? He wasn't able to get a lot of the things that he campaigned for through.
Yeah, that's true. And that is partly, I think, because of what followed him, who followed him rather. But we will still, I feel like people still remember Obama fondly. And I think, that part was forgotten to an extent. So I'm guessing that's probably what Macron is hoping for.
Gavin, is this quest by politicians to be cool actually quite damaging to politics? Because as Marie's just explained, voters get very frustrated when the exciting politician who they initially got excited about taking selfies around the country actually isn't doing anything to change their lives or tries to do so, but doesn't have the political capital in order to do so.
That's right. I think there is a growing frustration, and Macron was elected more by default. It was a block on Marine Le Pen and the National Front. But let's not forget, 11 million people voted for Marine Le Pen. And while that party, he's been incredibly lucky about with the fact that his opponents have disintegrated, the socialists, centre-right Republicans, the National Front. Marine Le Pen ran a completely disastrous campaign, particularly between the first and the second rounds of the election. And so He did come to office, although not many people voted for him. Only about half of the 20 million voted for him out of conviction and arrest to block Marine Le Pen. He did come with some goodwill, and he's enjoyed a honeymoon period, but he really hasn't handled it well with the what we've already talked about, and just sort of being more interested in self-promotion. And interestingly, I mean, this week, it's very appropriate, but we're talking about this week, and he's playing the King of Cool, because on Monday he had Bono, the singer of U2, at the Elysee. Today he's hosting Rihanna, and this is prompted, we were already seeing a reaction on Tuesday, a police union which had unsuccessfully tried to contact Macron to discuss working conditions for the police in France posted a message on social media saying it was looking to recruit a showbiz star, because this is obviously the best way, the only way to get Macron's attention. Now, if it's two institutions you don't want to antagonise at this moment in France, it's the police and the military, because they're going to be required by Macron in the coming months. And yet he just seems oblivious. He seems so preoccupied with promoting himself and enjoying the limelight that he's not dealing with the very important domestic issues.
But at some point, Marie, even those stars won't want to hang out with him, because at the moment he's an exciting new president. Soon he'll just be a boring politician.
Yes, and I'm not really sure that's something he's ready for quite yet. And I think part of the issue as well, which I think is a bit of a like taboo in politics, but he really is enjoying himself, and I don't think deep down people really want to see their politicians sort of like really enjoying themselves.
He's a bit dazzled
by
it, is he?
Yes.
Yeah.
He's having the time of his life. You know, and why wouldn't you? But also he probably should stop looking so excited by it all.
That was Gavin Mortimer and Marie Leconte.
Hello, I'm Sam Leith, literary editor of The Spectator, and I present the weekly books podcast, at which you'll hear lively discussions from the best and most interesting critics and writers and authors out there, from Charlotte Rampling to Daniel Dennett, all the way past to Michael Morpurgo. I very much hope you'll give us a try. Just search for Spectator Books on the iTunes store.
Next, with Parliament adjourned for recess, political eyes are turning to Brussels, where the Brexit negotiations have begun in earnest. In his column this week, James Forsyth worries about how exactly the UK will make its departure, whilst on Coffee House, Ed West, a Leaver, advocates for a second referendum now that the deal seems to be going south. They both join me now. So, Ed, you've said that you would support a second referendum on Britain's membership of the EU. Do you not think that that would have most British voters running for the hills?
I think it would be absolutely hellish. I couldn't bear it at all. My main point, though, is that I think I've written this before, is that we voted to leave, but we didn't vote to leave and replace anything in particular whether we sort of have an EEA model or the Norway model or something else. And in that sense, you know, once negotiations have begun and a minister or the cabinet minister felt that the deal we had wasn't ideal, then I think it would be reasonable for them to say this alternative on offer, you know, isn't great for us. So hand on heart, let's have another vote on it. I can see there'll be terrible pushbacks for sort of democracy and it'll be tremendously unpopular. But I think the alternative is if we end up with something which is a terrible deal, which ruins the economy, is, you know, it's going to not just ruin the economy, but it's going to basically put the Conservatives out of power for 25 years and make Brexiteers sort of the most unpopular people in modern British history.
James, you've written in your politics column this week that the Cabinet are starting to agree on various things regarding Brexit. Have you picked up from any Cabinet ministers any sort of desire, private or shared with others, for a second referendum?
No, I don't think there is any desire for a second referendum, for the simple fact that the second referendum has the same problem as the first referendum. It's not clear what people are voting for. So let's say you went to the public saying, do you want this deal that Theresa May has negotiated or to stay in? I don't think it's at all clear that you could stay in on the previous terms. You know, that you could well turn around, but the Europeans say, OK, you can come back into the EU, but you've got to lose your rebate, and you've got to promise to join the single currency at some point. You know, I don't think the second referendum solves that, because the problem with the referendum is referendums and parliamentary democracy don't go very well together.
As we've learned.
No, indeed, because there is this problem, which is people aren't sure what they voted for. And the same thing would be true in another referendum. If you wanted to leave the EU, but you think the deal concedes too much to the European Union, for example, on not competing with them on environmental standards or labour standards or corporate taxation, which way do you vote in that referendum on yes, no? And I think this is the problem, which is the yes, no referendums don't really address questions like this. That is the problem with this. It would have been much better if you had had a party running a general election saying, we want to leave the European Union, this is how we envisage doing so, this is the economy we want to create afterwards, and they had won 326 seats. That would have been a much better situation than the situation I think we find ourselves in.
Yeah, I suppose I'm arguing, you know, retrospectively, is that that would have been my ideal. So instead of this turning into a leave-remain thing, in which basically it becomes a kind of cultural argument about, you know, what do you hate in the world and which side are you on, we had a particular direction of where we're going. Because in any other sphere of life, if you're going to move one organisation, generally you have a plan for where you're going else. You don't just, like, do I hate this organisation, what it represents. You know, realistically, I can see that that's not going to happen. All I was saying is that as someone who voted to leave, and I'm not, you know, I'm a very, I suppose, moderate, sceptical leave voter, I would not think it was a huge, you know, insult to my intelligence or as a voter if they said, OK, we're in a bit of a pickle now and, you know, we can either have a referendum now or have potentially worse...
I personally completely accept the argument that it is totally legitimate for people to wish for Britain to rejoin the EU. I think this idea that you've had one referendum and that solves the question for all time,
yeah,
that's kind of nonsense on stilts. I think there is a problem, which is I don't see how you would phrase a second referendum question that wouldn't encounter all the problems of the first referendum.
I mean, the government could, for example, say, OK, we've reached this thing where we won't have border thing, we have free movement, that has to be one of the things. Do you vote for this as an endorsement of this kind of sort of moderate, sort of soft Brexit? Which some of, and, you know, they could say, well, at least we now have the support of the public.
But then my question to that would be, and this is where it's not a yes-no question, which is, what happens to the people, the Nick Cleggs of this world, who would say, hang on a second, the Norway option, for example, yeah, right? I'm with Matthew Paris on this. I don't see how you can possibly argue that the Norway option is better than EU membership, in that you are essentially accepting the single market, all the EU regulations, the four freedoms that that entails, ECJ jurisdiction, albeit at one remove via the EFTA court. I don't see how accepting that in perpetuity as opposed to in transition could be seen to be being better than being in the EU.
By definition, wouldn't be forever, because it always leaves the option of further, you know, move. And the EU itself, I mean, in a sense, I think the referendum is slightly relevant because, you know, the core EU is moving towards closer union. Yeah. There's always going to be an outer thing. So we've just had this quite hateful and angry, you know, referendum for almost no reason, in a sense. We are always going to be on this periphery, and I think we're always going to have some sort of Norway option. The fact is, we have to have some of these regulations. It's just a fantasy. I think it's a fantasy to suggest we can be completely free of it.
James, where is the government now on this? You say there is some agreement in the cabinet. You say, though, that the government's sort of power in terms of threatening no deal has been diminished by the election.
I think one of the problems is this, is that if Theresa May had won a majority of 60 or so at the election, that no deal threat would have been very real and very potent, because with a Tory majority of 60, it actually would have been possible to pass sweeping changes to the UK's tax and regulation if you crashed out of the EU without a deal. And I think because the European Union don't want a low tax, low regulation economy on their doorstep, they would have been more prepared to offer a reasonable deal to prevent that from happening. I mean, the problem is the no deal threat now no longer carries much potency, because I don't see how you could get, in a hung parliament, I don't see how you could get big changes to tax and regulation through. And so therefore, if Britain left without a deal, we would be left without a deal and trying to muddle on. Yeah, well, both worlds, exactly. That would be my concern. I think the thing that Brexiteers should accept is a relatively long transition. Because a relatively long transition, as long as it has a time limit on it, as long as it has an end point at some point, would enable you to prepare for leaving without a great deal. Because I think one of the problems is the EU's inclination is going to be to say, not only will you have to accept consumer product standards when you export into the EU, but we want you to organise your economy in a distinctively European way.
So
you're not a threat. And that's the only way we'll sign a trade deal for you. Again, I think it is the worst of both worlds to end up agreeing to do that, leave the single market, and then trying to compete in the rest of the world with one hand tied behind your back.
How long do you see this transition for?
I mean, I'm perfectly happy. I mean, the European Parliament talked about 3 years. I'm perfectly happy with that. I'm also happy with longer than 3 years, as long as in the legislation there is a sunset clause, at which point it ends.
Do you think most cabinet ministers are happy with that as well?
I think most cabinet ministers are happy with 3 years. I mean, in the Tory party, the consensus is, as long as the transition ended at least 1 month before the next election in May 2022, they're all right with that.
But we have seen some complaints from the Conservative backbenches. We've seen John Barron, for instance, who's actually the man responsible in some ways for the EU referendum, for where we are now, because he was the one who was pushing David Cameron into calling an EU referendum under the coalition. He's been complaining about a transitional period. Are those complaints serious, or is it just noises off?
I think the number of leavers who are opposed to a limited transitional period as opposed to an unlimited one is relatively small. And I think that...
But you don't need that many, do you? Given
no, but I think enough Labour MPs would vote for a transition that she'd be all right on that, Theresa May would be all right on that. And I think Ed's point also concentrates Tory minds. There is a view that falling out of the EU without a deal will potentially would have, you know, appalling economic consequences. And I mean, that concentrates a lot of Tory minds. And I also think the other thing is this. One of the things to remember is lots of the long-time veteran Tory leavers have always believed in relatively mild solutions. So, you know, EEA or EFTA or whatever. So I don't think you're going to find them viscerally opposed to a transition. Actually, ironically, it's those people who came to the cause relatively late who favour a cleaner break.
And Ed, it's not just about no deal with Europe, is it? It's about trade deals with non-EU countries. And we've seen Liam Fox in the States this week starting talks on this. Now, this is a very complex debate, and so it's almost natural that people find symbols to use to talk about it rather than the details, which is why we've ended up talking about chlorinated
chicken. Everyone's an expert on chlorinated chicken.
What have you made of the way the government has responded to this row about washing chicken?
The way I see it is that, you know, the EU is still 46% of our exports. To me, that is the golden thing to get a deal with the EU. If we don't get a deal with the EU, we are in real trouble. The problem with the EU thing is that, you know, viscerally, there are two sides in each extreme who love the idea of sovereignty, and then on the other side think that nation states are the cause of all evil. Everyone else wants some sort of compromise in between, basically. And the issue is unbelievably complicated. The more you read into it, it's just, you know, fathomless clauses that are all about not just, you know, non-barrier tariffs, non-tariff barriers, whatever. And you could just spend years and years trying to get into this subject, which makes me feel really lack of confidence in the current cabinet having to do this in, you know, in 2 years, when the main focus to me should be on the EU deal.
Do you agree with that, James?
Look, I think the thing about what scares me is that I think that the pro-free trade forces in this country are hideously out of practice. We haven't had a trade policy for 40 years.
Very unfashionable. Sort of
and change. So, but what you've got going is that the losses from the extra competition that free trade creates, they are concentrated. The benefits are diffuse. So all the producer interests are ready to go.
Yeah.
And the consumers who would benefit from more choice and cheaper prices, they're not organised. They're incoherent. There's no one saying, right, I'm going to speak up on behalf of the British consumer, saying, OK, chlorine washed chicken might not be everyone's cup of tea, but American chicken is £3 cheaper a carcass than UK chicken, so maybe we should let people make this choice. I mean, this is the problem.
And just finally, James, this time last year, Theresa May was repeatedly saying Brexit means Brexit and we are going to make a success of it. We don't hear that vow, we are going to make a success of it, so much anymore. Is the government's slogan now, we're going to get this done one way or the other?
I wouldn't quite put it like that, but I think the government is... I think it is worth remembering that Theresa May herself was a Remainer. And I think what you saw, and I think it's one of lots of the explanations of what has gone wrong over the last year, has been an attempt by Theresa May to overcompensate for not having been a Brexiteer in the first place. And that's why she felt the need to attack Citizens of Nowhere in her conference speech. That's why she felt the need to kind of sound so dismissive of any argument about slowing the process or doing it more gradually.
I agree.
Which I think has all been a mistake. I mean, weirdly enough, politically, to pitch yourself to 52% of the electorate rather than trying to say I'm the person who can bring the whole country together is always a mistake.
That was James Forsyth and Ed West. And finally, culture vultures from around the world will be descending on the Scottish capital in the next few weeks for the Edinburgh Festival. In the magazine this week, Lloyd Evans previews the carnival of comedy, theatre and music, but condemns the official non-fringe element to obscurity. He joins us now along with the stand-up comedian Matt Ford, who is performing a show hastily rewritten in light of recent events again at the festival. So Lloyd, you say in the magazine this week that the Edinburgh Festival has actually had its day and there's no point in flocking there at all. Why is that?
Well, I'm talking about the International Festival, which was the original version of the festival, and it's become rather arid and remote from the real beating heart of the festival, which is the fringe, and that keeps expanding and getting ever larger. And so that's really the point I was making, which is that the original thing has become slightly redundant and it's been overtaken by the fringe, which is sort of like a YouTube thing, like an analog version of YouTube. It's lots of people just turning up and showing off and trying to get as large an audience as they can get. So really, YouTube should have killed it off, but actually it's getting even bigger. You know, every year it expands, keeps expanding. It's now up to over 3,200 performances, and it shows no sign of stopping.
And just for the benefit of those listeners who have always assumed that the Edinburgh Festival is the fringe, is stand-up comedians standing in empty pubs hoping that someone might turn up, what's the difference between the International Festival and the fringe?
Well, the International Festival originated really during the Second World War. They thought that they needed to do something to repair the cultural damage done to Europe. And it began really as a festival of music as well as drama. And at the very first Fringe 70 years ago, 1947, a group of poachers sort of turned up. They saw these audiences arriving for this festival. And I think eight companies, theatre companies, arrived and set up their own alternative entertainments to try and lure the crowds towards them. So the tradition began of two festivals in parallel, an official international festival, which is still there, and the Fringe, which is still there and still growing.
Matt Fawes, you're a stand-up comedian who will hopefully be playing to packed-out venues. Yes, have you been to the International Festival, or has it always all been about the Fringe for you?
Well, it's always been about the Fringe for me. I'm slightly embarrassed that I've been going there for 7 or 8 years now and I've probably never seen anything on the International Festival. I've seen plenty of things on the Fringe, but it is right to draw the distinction that the International Festival really... It'd be interesting to know what the numbers are in terms of how many people go to what part. But that feels like a sort of more distant official thing that takes place in grander venues, things like ballet and opera, perhaps. And the Edinburgh Festival, as people think of it, is, as you say, comedians in empty pubs.
And are you looking forward to it this year? Or is it something you view with mixed feelings, a bit like political journalists with party conference?
I suppose it's different with journalists because for comedians, we're the performers. So in a way, it would be more like the politicians looking forward to party conference. And I think a lot of them do for the same reasons that we do, that it's nice to get everyone together because the rest of the year, you're sort of in all of the parts of the UK. And it is, from a comedian's point of view, the most exciting thing is writing a brand new show and then getting to show it off at the best festival in the world. So that's the most thrilling part of it. There are downsides, which is too long. You're having to do the same show 25 times.
Have you ever performed to One Man and His Dog?
Not in Edinburgh, luckily. I've always done well for numbers in Edinburgh so far. Oh, elsewhere. I mean, I remember doing a gig in Chesterfield where the microphone was looped over a fag machine. So you had to kind of tilt your head upwards as sort of Liam Gallagher would. And I was on after some performance poet. There were three people there and four dogs. So not quite One Man and His Dog, but almost.
Lloyd, has the culture of the Fringe changed in recent years? You suggest in your piece that you think it might have become quite sanitised and quite sort of concerned with social issues.
I suppose it has in a way. I mean, one thing I was interested in pointing out is that every year there's an official Best Joke of the Year award. And it usually goes to something very anodyne, like Dan Antopolsky's joke, which is hedgehogs, why can't they just share? Which is not the greatest joke ever. The best joke I've heard at the Fringe in the last 5 years. The joke is, it was a different age, the 1970s. The Sex Offenders Register was called the Radio Times. Now, That could never win the Joke of the Year award because the BBC wouldn't want to publicise it. So there is a certain amount of censorship and sanitisation going on. But of course, you'll still find very edgy stuff happening. I mean, I went about 5 years ago. I saw a comedian, a stand-up comedian, who headbutted a heckler that he didn't like. And the heckler ended up in hospital and the stand-up comedian ended up in court. So there's still plenty of scope for dangerous stuff, which is great.
I would like to just take this opportunity to apologise for that.
Yeah, and
it's been lovely talking to you again.
You got out of jail in the end.
Matt, are you longing for more jokes about sex offenders or physical violence at the Fringe?
I don't really long for jokes on a particular subject because two comedians could treat a subject very differently. You could get people doing jokes about sex offenders that was sort of very old hat and not particularly funny. You get people who go too far and then you get people who would get it right. So I don't think any subject should ever be off limits. It's just the manner in which that subject's treated. So as with every year, there's always a thrill to discovering comedians you haven't heard of, perhaps people, or equally, people that you have heard of that really take a step forward. And that's always, I would see it in that sort of way, is rather than a particular subject, it's good seeing talent develop.
Lloyd, what makes the best sort of Fringe show? I know they're very diverse. You can get children's shows, you can get political comedy like Matt's, you can get sort of confessional comedy like Ruby Wax's. What, in your view, is the most effective?
I mean, I went to see Reginald D. Hunter about 8 or 9 years ago before he was on TV, and his show was... It was entitled Pride and Prejudice and N-Word. And I thought, this is going to be interesting. And there were an audience of about 12 people, and he was doing some very macabre stuff. And he pointed to a girl in the audience with blonde hair and said to her, "Have you ever had a sexual fantasy involving a man darker than yourself?" And she said, "I'm 14. And this is an incredibly difficult moment. And he immediately switched to the woman next to her, who was older than her and was her mother. And he sort of made fun of it and said, well, hang on, what are you doing? Why are you bringing this little blameless little girl to this hideous, dark, you know, world that I'm creating with my comedy? And it was really, really funny. And it's a shame it was never filmed. I mean, it was just really weird and strange and uncomfortable for everyone. And Reginald D. Hunter was absolutely brilliant about it. And so actually with the audience, it was hilarious. So it's that kind of really unexpected moment that is the great thing about stand-up comedy. And it's better than the theatre. It's better even than Parliament. And, you know, sometimes it's the most dramatic thing you can see.
I'm shocked, Lloyd, that you would suggest that there's somewhere that's funnier than Parliament. But Matt, what shows will you be looking out for if you've got any time off from your own?
Oh, crikey. There's certain people that I always go and see. Tim Vine is brilliant, who writes best one-liners in the world. Terry Alderton is great. Rose Matafeo is a newer act who I previewed with in Brighton the other week, who's fantastic. I mean, there's always stuff that you discover while you're up there. And that's the great thrill of it. There'll be people that you've never heard of who become a sort of breakout hit at the festival. So at the moment, I was going to see friends and things that are hotly tipped. But I'd like to think that I would come back from the festival with a recommendation that I haven't yet heard of.
Lloyd, can it get a bit earnest at times? Obviously, political comedy can be very funny, but political shows can also end up being a little bit tedious.
They can be. I mean, there's one strand that I've noticed, which is that stand-up comedians tend to make a lot of racist jokes, but they always ascribe the racist joke. The punchline is always that it was actually Nigel Farage who said it or Donald Trump who said it. And so they create this sense of belonging in the room with the audience by isolating a different group whose values are not accepted and who are kind of looked down on. And that, funnily enough, is really the essence of bigotry. And I see that happening an awful lot. And it always slightly depresses me when you get this kind of moral tribalism going on. So that can be a bit earnest. I'm always on the lookout for comedians who I think are left-wing but have got a bit fed up with being left-wing. And there's a great guy I saw last week at a preview called Finn Taylor, who's excellent. And I think I predicted that Matt himself might be moving towards the right, although probably that prediction will turn out to be incorrect. But that's what I find fun, is somebody who's transitioning, as it were.
Matt, as someone who is transitioning from the left to disgruntled left, who are you looking forward to impersonating the most?
Oh, crikey. I mean, I always do try and... I always deliberately take the mick out of everyone. So Leavers and Remainers, Tory and Labour equally all get it, as well as Lib Dems.
Is Theresa May more exciting to impersonate than she is as an election campaigner?
Not really, no. She's quite... I find her quite hard to deal with for comedy. So you have to deal with the fact that she's humiliated herself, that she's a slight embarrassment, and deal with those things, the sort of human side of that, effectively that failure of an election. So that's a good area for comedy. And obviously the hypocrisies that people have noticed, that warning against a coalition of chaos are now effectively technically being in one. So they're all good areas to which seems to be mined. Donald Trump is my favourite person to impersonate at the moment. And I mean, this won't come across necessarily in audio, but his facial and the way that he talks and the way that he is so gentle. Even when he's talking about things, they're so divisive. By the way, the most divisive things, and I will talk about them, but I don't talk about them all the time. You know, that kind of constant repetition and the odd, very odd audio experience that he is. So he's in there. I've managed to get Ed Miliband is in there as well. And there's a bit of Blair and a bit of... Who else is in there? Oh, there's lots of Boris. Boris is great to do because he's got... doesn't really matter what question you ask him. There is a carousel of 10 answers that you will get. So if you were to have him here and say, Boris, where is that £350 million for the NHS? No. Let me firstly address this issue of Jeremy Corbyn, who, by the way, and if this was indeed talking about the BBC, and I mean, I would always say that my favourite would be a chocolate hobnob. So it doesn't matter what you ask him, you will get the sort of flurry of replies on a variety of different answers. So Boris features quite heavily this year.
Do you try to convey a political message in your performances? Is there an argument you're trying to get across? Or do you just want to mock everyone and stop politicians across the board from being too big for their boots?
Yes, I'm certainly always trying to be fair and even-handed in dishing it out to all quarters equally. But at the moment, actually, I suppose there is a bit more... slight opinion coming through, not a great deal, but just particularly on things like immigration, where I feel like the country's got itself in quite a sort of regressive stance. Particularly as we approach Brexit, I think I would rather have more talented people coming here and not less. So there's a point about that, I guess, and just about how you know, and this is a point for left and right. I make a point about taxation and finance, that nothing comes for free. So until we change our attitude to that, we're not going to be able to solve the problems we have as a country. So there are kind of small things like that. One point that actually has really come through, and this is almost by accident, is the era in which we live really troubles me in terms of the tone of it. And the fact that we have lost the pleasure of sitting down opposite someone that we disagree with and still enjoying their company is something that really troubles me. And you see that online, and I have to say it's equal on left and right. The desire not to win a debate, but to prevent a debate even taking place is something that really worries me. And that is a theme that has emerged.
That was Lloyd Evans and Matt Ford. And that's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. You can also subscribe to our other shows, including Holy Smoke, our religion podcast hosted by Damien Thompson and Christina Odoni. And if you enjoy the podcasts, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed on the podcast, as well as great pieces by Lara Prendergast, David Starkey and Julie Burchill. And we have a special offer for podcast listeners. 12 issues for £12 and a limited edition Spectator moleskin notebook if you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/podoffer. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.